Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a terrific episode for you today. Kenny Anderson, former NBA All-Star, is here to talk about what it was like being a high school phenom in New York, surviving a roller coaster NBA career, and he takes us through a tough experience that he had in childhood. That's next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Welcome back. Another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Anyone that knows me and has followed any part of my career knows that the most formative, defining sports years for me were the 8 years I spent working for the Boston Celtics. Ball kid, running around, being around the team, and one of the best players of that team and one of the defining years for the Celtics. This is back when the Celtics in the late 90s, early 2000s, where it was rough. It was before the championship. But when they were good, when they were Eastern Conference finalists, this man right here was the starting point guard. Kenny Anderson, Pride of New York. What's up, Kenny?
Chris, oh, man. When I saw you, I was like, wow, I'm doing it for my guy, Chris. I remember those moments, you know, when you was around the Celtics, the team. And great times. Like you said, it was rough at times. You know, I was there for 5 years. I think 2 years was rough, but then we started coming around and winning.
Yeah, and two things that I remember the most about those years. One, you coming made the team really good.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Chauncey eventually became a good player, but at that time, he just wasn't old enough or mature enough to help that team, particularly when the other part of it was, and you probably don't even remember any of this, but every time you would go out, I would find a way to find out where you were going and sort of tag along the back end. I'm not kidding. Like, I would call one of my buddies from Boston College. I was a junior or senior. I was 21, whatever. And you would go. And there were occasions when you would see me there. And oftentimes, at least two or three times, you'd just hand me like two bottles of champagne without glasses. Just
wow.
Be like, here you go. And it wasn't like you were all messed up. It was just like, hey, man, what's up? Here you go. And we were like, we're cool for the rest of the night. We're good.
Yeah, that was some great times in Boston. I love, you know, it killed me when I got traded because I had one more year left and free agent, you know, play for my free agent year. And I started smoking cigars in Boston in 1997 and became a cigar lover. But, Rick Pitino brought me there. It's kind of interesting that you said that early with Chauncey Billups. They had drafted him. But at that time, he was a tweener. He really didn't know how to, you know, play the point, and then he just, you know, he went to Detroit and blew up. But I got traded, you know, for Chauncey.
No, you were exactly what that team needed at that time because they were young, but they were good enough to make a run if they had an experienced point guard, and you were that guy. There's a lot I want to get to with you, but that team and playing for Rick Pitino, he's got to be an acquired taste in some ways for professionals. What was your experience like with Rick?
He's a great, one of my best coaches I ever had, but he wears his emotions on his sleeve. I think he's a better college coach, but pro, he's just a great coach. I think he tells it like it is, straightforward. I just think the pieces and the talent that we had playing in the Eastern Conference at that time, it was tough. It was tough, and he wasn't winning right away. And they had the dream of the Tim Duncan dream where they was going to get him in the draft and it would change everything, but it didn't work out that way. But I said, great coaches there, Jim O'Brien, Frank Vogel, who's now Orlando. Yeah. He was the video coordinator for that team. And I just think Rick was just, he wore his emotions on his sleeve, and losing got the best of him when he was in Boston.
Yeah, how many years did you play for Rick versus O'Brien?
Two and a half, or two with Rick Pitino, and Jim O'Brien, too.
I remember when he quit, and that was like mid-season, and he just didn't travel with you guys or something back up to Boston.
I think it was the Miami Heat game. We won that game. We went on, it's kind of ironic, when he stepped down, that's when things turned. You know, we that season, we finished on a high note, and they gave the job to Jim O'Brien. He was already on staff. He knew the personality of the team, knew the pulse of the team. And the following year, we third seed. You know, we won 50 games, so we were just playing extremely well.
How surprised were you guys from what you remember when Rick was like, I'm done? Did he tell you that he was done? Did he just not get on the plane?
I'm not sure. I don't remember, but like I said, it was getting to him. You could tell in his demeanor. You know what I mean? The losing, and as you know, Boston's
not for everybody.
No, it's not for everybody. It's a sports town. They know you can't fool them. You winning is great, but yeah. You're losing, it could be very tough. And we had some tough times there. I had some tough times. They wanted to kick me out, take my head off. You know, but I'm from New York. I was tough-skinned. I knew how to deal with it. It is what it is. But, you know, I don't remember. I knew it was getting rough for him. But I think he knew it was time for another voice, you know, and that's what happened.
What was weird about Rick, too, there was he had so many of his college guys. Like, there was... Yeah. Ron Mercer was around for a while. Antoine was there. Walter McCarty was there. I mean, these guys were the guys that played for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, he went with the young.
Yeah.
And then the style of play was different. He was pressing. And, you know, NBA, that was like, that's hard to do, you know, pressing, you know, night in and night out. You know what I mean? But I love him. And I always will. He brought me to Boston. I love being in Boston. It's close to New York, where I'm from. And just, you know, I got the chance to play for a story, tradition, organization. And I left on a high. You know, I left. They traded me after we went to the Eastern Conference Finals. So I have no regrets. It just, you know, sometimes certain things don't work out. But yeah, I wish I could have finished my last year there. And it would have helped me far as business-wise a great deal.
I hated when they traded you. Yeah. Like, that was, I mean, I didn't know if that team could have won anything, but I hate, like, without you there and the experience of a point guard there, it hurt.
I thought we should have tried it one more year. We went to the Eastern Conference Finals, and I was hoping and praying that they give that team another shot, because we lost to the Eastern Conference Finals to the New Jersey Nets with Jason Kidd, and I had one more year left, so that was my free agent year. So I was looking forward to having a big year, you know, with the same team. I was comfortable, did everything they asked, community loved me. It was just a great fit for me.
That was a tough finals, conference finals, because you had that moment, the greatest comeback in NBA playoff history. I think it was 26 down or something in that fourth quarter. How much do you remember of that game?
It was crazy. Now, sitting back, you know, when people tell you about it and you watch some of the clips, it's amazing. You know, I was like, we down, okay, it's playoffs. We down by 20. Let's make this respectable for the next game. You know, let's not just get the doors blown off. And we just kept fighting, kept grinding. And all of a sudden, they got tight. The game got close, and we pulled it out. It was somewhere about 23 points, I believe, going into the fourth, 12 minutes. It was a great turnaround.
And Boston people like to tell me that that year, you guys had, I think you had beaten the Lakers a couple of times.
Yeah.
Like, this was like people in Boston that were part of that group still look back at that as like, you know, we could have taken the Lakers that year. That was Shaq and Kobe that year.
Exactly.
They believed.
They believed, number one. Number two, we just had a unique style of play. Shot a lot of threes. You know, Antoine Walker, Paul Pierce, and myself. You know, I was totally the offense. And we played extremely great defense. I think we finished the lead is the third best defensive team in the league. Mm-hmm. We made the game ugly. You know what I mean? I don't think we could have handled Shaq, but Paul Pierce was pushing Kobe. That would have been a push. If we would have did all our other things, who knows? You know what I mean? But we couldn't control Shaq. I think one of the games we beat them that year, Shaq didn't play. Mm-hmm. But we did beat them in L.A. And that's, you know, you never know. I look back on that, and New Jersey got swept. You never know.
What happened when you think back at after the big win in game three? You come back and win. The killer must have been losing game four on your home floor, letting the Nets, you know, letting them get back into it like that.
I tell you, Paul Pierce missed the free throws. I'll tell you what happened.
Still,
I know
resonates.
He might don't want to hear that. But, you know, he missed the 1-1 and missed the free throw. And, you know, I think we would have been up one. We would put the game in overtime, something. But it just was – in that year, we dominated the Nets. I think we took them for granted. You know, we just pretty much knew, you know, going into it, we was going to come out of the East. We were so confident. Mm-hmm. And then I think when the pressure got to us, when the Nets, you know, won that game, and we just was a little bit too confident, I thought.
We're doing this podcast from back here in New York, where you had so many memories. I mean, Archbishop Molloy, star. I mean, you were one of the first prep stars. I mean, you probably would have gone. I mean, did you consider going into the draft right out of high school?
No, never did. I did. Physically, I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
And mentally, I was just, at that time, you know, I love, you know, college. I was going, my mentor, you know, was just mainly trying to get a scholarship because my mother couldn't afford it just to go to college, to get out of, you know, my neighborhood, get my mother, you know, out of the struggle. So I know I wasn't thinking about NBA. I was just thinking about going to college.
But how big did it get for you as a star in New York?
It was huge. I'm doing my documentary right now on Mr. Chibs. You can go to the website, MrChibs.com. I was 14, 15 years old. I got more attention than the Knicks, Nets, Jets, Giants, Islanders, Rangers. It was all Kenny Anderson. I was back in the New York Newsday, Daily News, everywhere. You know, matter of fact, I did the Kathy Lee and Regents, you know, when I was like 14, 15, when they first started the show. So I've gotten so much publicity at an early age. It was a child prodigy, you know what I mean? So it's just coming back home is just awesome for me. You know, it's just a bittersweet because my mother passed away, you know, about 10 years ago. Then my father passed away 2 months ago. So there's not, my parents is not here, but for me, it's just great memories.
How does a 14, 15-year-old handle all that attention?
I don't know. I don't know. It was a blur, man. You know, I look back at it. I had some good, support team. You know, Vincent Smith, my mentor, Pierre Turner, Jack Curran, rest in peace. Archbishop Malloy mean the world to me. You know, my school. Every time I try to go back and visit, every time I'm here, I just was around some good people. And also, my mother always used to say, I was just one of those kids that listened. You know, I didn't have so many distractions like this generation has. I was just about trying to play basketball. And then when I went to Malloy, I had to work extremely hard academically to stay there and to stay on the team. So that's what I did.
How much, I mean, there still must have been a lot of people trying to put their hand in your pocket, trying to become, you know, your guy. Because everybody knows where you were going. Well, at that point,
with me, it's strange. They, you know, I asked some guys in my neighborhood, Left Rack City. Mm. Who, you know, like there's a saying that takes a village to raise one child. You know, my village, Left Rack City, they wouldn't let nobody, you know, harm me. Nobody. They watched over me like a hawk. It was numerous guys. You know what I mean? So they always told me what was right from wrong and stay on a steady path. You got great potential. You can make something out of yourself. And I just listened. I could have easily went left, but I just listened. I was one of those kids that listened and wanted to be successful and wanted to basically go to college.
I've heard that from, and actually I was just around Brandon Ingram, the kid from Duke, yeah, who was telling me something similar. Was like, you know, he grew up in Kinston, North Carolina, rough area, but he had these people that kind of identified him as someone going places and almost built a bubble around him. Is that what you're saying? Kind of
exactly. Mm. That's exactly what happened to me. It was a bubble. You know, they watched over me. They told me when things was going to go down in the neighborhood to get upstairs, not to, you know, hang out late and all that. And, you know, I've done that a few times. I didn't listen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I used to hang out late and do all different things. But thank God, nothing never came out of it. I never got hurt doing it.
What's a situation, like an example of that? Something they told you, yo, man, you gotta stay away from this. Something's going to go down
here.
Well,
it was a true story. You know, the day before I left to go to college, Georgia Tech, one of my good friends got gunned down on the block. It was a drive-by shooting right on the block. I had just left about an hour ago upstairs. You know, it was late, one of those late nights. I was saying bye to everybody. I was just chilling out on the block. You know what I mean? And somebody came around and shot up the corner, you know, where we were standing. And my brother jumped in the bushes. And my good friend, Derek McDonald, you know, got shot and got killed. And, you know, something like that. I could have easily stayed out. What if I would have just stayed with them, just, you know, chopping it up with them? I would have been killed. You know, who knows? Bullet would have hit me. I wouldn't have made it. And the next day, I was actually, I was packed, get my flight. I was ready to go to Atlanta. And I was gone. And I left. It was so sad.
How did you, Georgia Tech was your choice to go to college. Mm-hmm. You spent the year there. Why Georgia Tech? Why, I'm sure everyone wanted a piece of you then.
I was just, you know, my mother, number one, she told me to go there. I was interested in Syracuse, but my mother, you know, really fell in love with Bobby Crimmins. He was from the Bronx. He recruited my mother, and my mother felt comfortable with him. I was a mama's boy, so my mom's like, I think you should go to Georgia Tech. So that's what I decided to go to. Another reason, you know, Mark Price was there. Like, if I seen him play, I was just watching an NCAA game against Georgetown versus Georgia Tech. I was like 17, 18. This was time they was recruiting me, and I seen them just come off pick and rolls, shoot, breaking down players, just running and gunning and just having fun out there. I was like, what school is this? Who is this guy? And I just fell in love with the way he let Mark Price play.
Kenny, hang on for just a second. I got to tell my listeners about the great new pair of shoes I got from Jack Irwin. These are some of the best looking and well-constructed shoes on the market, handcrafted in Spain and in Portugal. I got mine, brown pair. I wear them all the time. The average price, just $195, and they do that by bypassing retail markups and selling direct to the consumer. Other shoes at the same quality cost 2 to 3 times more. Jack Irwin's are a modern take on classic designs, reliable, built to last, and they're comfortable shoes that conform to your foot over time. Styles range from lace-ups and boots to loafers, casual to dress, everything you could possibly want. New casual offerings include drivers and boat shoes, available in various colors. Look good, get yourself some new shoes. Go to www.jackirwin.com right now and receive free expedited shipping on your purchase by using my code Chris. That's www.jackirwin.com. Select the expedited shipping option on the site and enter the code Chris to receive the offer. That's jackirwin.com. Enter code Chris at checkout to get free shipping on your order.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
I've always felt, Kenny, that one of the best stories I could ever write would be finding like some high school phenom who would just open up to all the nonsense and the craziness that goes on with the recruiting process, because for years it must be madness and there's got to be a lot of unsavoriness involved with. Now it's hard to get any high school kid to want to do that just because, you know, you've got to go on and play, and I don't know how you'd be perceived if you did that. But how was it crazy for you, like the people trying to get to you and how they tried to get
like
to you?
Like I said, it wasn't because I had a tight coach. Yeah. Everything back then was you had to go through the high school coach. Now it's the travel ball, AAU, the street agents. When I was in school, my high school coach didn't play around, so everything was done the right way. Vincent Smith, my mentor, also was a straightforward guy, Pierre Turner. So I stayed in my little bubble. I was in Queens. It was hard to get to me, but I really wasn't listening to everything. I was really fine, you know, doing, having the things I had. I was comfortable. So, you know, I didn't deal with it. That's one of the reasons I decided to go to pick before the year. I wasn't, these kids now are like, oh, my choices are down to 10. I got my choice down to 20. I'm like, man, that's crazy. I didn't want to deal with that before school. I wanted to know before school started everything, where I was going to school, and just concentrate on my year and just chilling out.
Well, it's now programming. It's now like ESPNU broadcasting the decision of the third best nose tackle up in northern Vermont or something like that.
I think about it. That's one reason I'm doing my documentary, The Mess. If they would have followed me, it was no tech. I would have broke the internet. You know what I mean? It would have been crazy. You know, I think I still had a lot of publicity. When I decided, I had a press conference. It was like all the major newspapers in New York. About 4 or 5 newspapers came. And, I told them where I was going to Georgia Tech. I think it was Daily News, Newsday, New York Post, stuff that they covered it. But that was it. But now with all the media and the television and stuff like that, I would have been overbearing.
You mentioned the documentary, and one of the things I was curious about as you're doing this, when you do a documentary, you expose your life to everyone, tough parts of your life too. You're deep into this process. When you think about what you've had to put out there, what's been the toughest part of your life story to tell to this point?
Well, a lot of times, like you said, I'm doing my doc. I wasn't going to do it, but I talked to my wife, and for months I held back. I was like, she's like, if you do it, you got to be real, man. You got to tell the truth. You got to help somebody, they can see your development, not only as a basketball player, but as a person. And so I went, and I think the hardest was when I had to come out with it. I don't even like talking about it. Molested as a child. And it was like therapy for me. I just wanted to help other kids because I'm on that platform. Kenny Anderson came out. He talked about it. Maybe I could, if something is going on right now, I could stop it early. I held it in for 30-something years. That's why, maybe I acted out and did some of the things I've done to some of the women I was with, or just some of the way I carried myself. It was tough, but that's the main thing. And I didn't want no pat on the back, no sympathy or nothing. Just, hey, I'm telling my story to help somebody else, to get some of these other kids that might hear it. Say, damn, Kenny Anderson, he came out, he was an all-star, an NBA player, the college All-American. Maybe I could ask him some questions, get in touch with him, and see how to deal with this, or come out of the closet, and you can live a productive life. I had fame at an early age, so I was able to throw it in the closet. Some kids don't have anything. They go to drugs, alcohol, suicide. It's really bad out there for this type of stuff. And I was like, man, somebody like me coming out can help. I didn't think about myself. I just was thinking about others.
When you look back at, because you did have all the fame and you had all the success, and knowing you a little bit back then, you never would have imagined that something like that had happened to you. Was it a daily challenge to bottle it up, or were you able to sort of compartmentalize it, push it away?
It wasn't daily with me because I was Kenny Anderson,
right?
You know, the NBA player. I had everything. So I was like normal. I act normal. But I guess the seriousness came because all the women that I dealt, they knew. They had a feeling, certain how I used to act and certain things I've done or whatever. But that goes deeper into the documentary zone of it. But, you know, that's where it got kind of, eerie, you know what I'm saying? Because the women and the people relationship that I had with me, they pretty much figured, like, you know, he act this way, he act that way, something's, going on in his life or whatever. So that's just how it was. But I was able to throw it in the closet because I had, the fame and the fortune and everything like that.
In the past, the stuff I've read about you and you talking about this, you've been reluctant to name who was involved in it. Do you do that in the documentary?
Yeah,
I did it
in the documentary. One of the youth coaches, out in Brooklyn. It wasn't my travel coach, Ernie Lloyd, rest in peace, from Riverside Church, or Lou Dalmano from the Gauchos, who I played with, who helped so many kids. It wasn't them two guys. So I didn't, people might be guessing and all that. Mm-hmm. Those guys were great for the inner city basketball, and they helped a lot of kids. They didn't do it.
Do you want something to happen to this person?
Well, my people tried, but, no, they're trying to locate them. Mm-hmm. But, what I'm saying? I didn't want, that's not me.
Right.
You got to learn how to forgive and forget. I'm moving on. I got therapy. I'm working. I get therapy now once a week. So it's, you got to work on yourself. You just can't come out and that's it. Like, it's normal. It's not normal. That stuff is not normal. I got kids. I got family. I'm trying to have a productive life. So you got to work on yourself. And I'm working on myself. That stuff is gone. I got to figure out the solution. The solution for me to live a productive life and not worry and keep and be bitter. You got to forgive. I'm just trying to break a cycle. Usually people break, have a cycle with that stuff. Those who hurt others, or, who's been molested, they molest other kids and all that. I don't see, for me seeing that at all, but you got to get help. And that's what I'm doing.
Was it good to get it out there when you did? Or, was it a relief in some ways?
Yeah, it was a relief because, I knew I was hiding something, But also it was a relief. So I hope it got, it got touched by other youth out there, people that's living with demons, that's living with secrets such as I did, that if they heard me, they'll go, even if it's quietly or discreet, they go get some help. So it won't be no cycle. So that's what I was hoping for. And maybe it did. I went to Portland, the Children's Center over there for kids that have been abused and molested. I've been over there 2-3 years and spoke at their luncheon. So I'm really big at that. And some grown men, some grown people come up to me and say, hey, I that's courageous that you did that. I'm going through my own issues, and thank you for coming out and it helped me. So that's a plus when that happens.
When you got drafted in 92, is that right, by 91. The Nets? 91. Was your reaction, all right, I'm going back to New York? Or was it, okay, I'm going back to New York?
Oh, it was like, yeah, I'm going back to New York. Yeah, I was happy. I was like, because all the people that followed me in my high school career was following me with my pro career. And I didn't have to go to Sacramento because Sacramento really, really wanted me. Mm-hmm. They was going to draft me 3. It was a done deal. And Nets had the second pick. Mm-hmm. So, that Willis Reed, drafted me. I was excited.
But did it turn out to be a good thing to go and back home?
Really, if you look back on it, everybody say my production, it didn't happen quickly over there. I didn't play my first year, and the second year came on. I just think with the Nets, Willis Reed and the organization at the time wasn't stable. We had some great I thought we had a great team with myself, Derek Coleman, Drazen Petrovic, but it wasn't long because Drazen got killed. Derek got traded, and it was seven owners. Just wasn't no stability. But I always wonder if we had more time, more serious owners and intact, if they was wanted to win more, I think we would have been fine. That's what happened with the Jason Kidd era. They just had more stability. Came in there, built a practice facility. The owner, the GM, they got serious about putting a team together, and then they kept it together for some years.
Traded in 96, first time you were traded. What did that feel like?
Oh, it was great. I kind of forced it. They was going to offer me a contract. I was going up to my free agent year mm-hmm. with the Nets. But, you know, like I said, Drazen had died. Derek Coleman had got, you know, got traded. And I just was a guy on the island by myself. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was time to move on, you mm-hmm. know.
So you move on to Charlotte for a minute and a half, basically.
Yeah, then I thought for half of the year, played very well. I had to play well because I wanted to, you know, keep my numbers and everything up, you know, because I was going into my free agent year. I thought they was going to sign me, play very well for them, but George Shinn had gave a lot of money to Larry Johnson, and he wasn't going to give no more money up. Mm-hmm. So kind of, you know, they didn't re-sign me. So then I got signed by the Portland Trail Blazers, which was great.
Yeah, what was that experience like going there?
I loved it. Yeah. I loved it, man. The road opened up the Rose Garden. Paul Allen is a great owner. The fans was great. I thought I would be there for a lot longer too. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of, you know, it's business. But it's interesting. Every time I play well, I got traded. So mm-hmm. it was like weird. You know what I mean? PJ Colissimo and Rick Carlisle was assistant. They got fired. They fired the staff, and then they let me go like 2 years into it. When I was playing some of my best ball.
You had a very good career in the NBA. Did it go the way you thought it was going to go when you were drafted by the Nets? I mean, what did you think was ahead of you?
I don't know. I ain't thinking about that, but now I look back, my numbers are good, and I don't have control. You don't have control on this business. That's who you play with. You know, then when you get comfortable playing with somebody, they get traded. Something happened, and like Nets, Drazen passed away. I can't control that. Then Derek gets traded. Who knows? We kept that team together another 3, 4, 5 years. I would have got re-signed with the Nets, and we would have been successful there, and I would have been there for a longer time. You know, get with Boston. You just don't know. Playing very well. Went to the Eastern Conference Final and get traded in the offseason. Maybe stay with that organization with Paul Pierce, you know, Antoine Walker another year. You know, things get better. There's a saying, you can only control what you can control. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Can't control things that you don't have no control over. And some of this stuff with NBA and teams and getting traded, I don't have no control over it.
What was the year you thought was your best year, that everything kind of came together about as well as it was going to come together?
See, Portland was awesome, numbers and all that, but that Boston year, it wasn't crazy. I was like, I think I averaged 12 and 7. It just wasn't.
But you were what that team needed. You were a leader when they needed one.
That's
a point guard leader.
I was a point guard leader, and I owe my guy, Dick Harder. Mm-hmm. It's my guy, man. I had many nights on a plane talking. I get a little emotional with talk about Dick Harder. He's a good dude. He was assistant coach.
Remember,
Got me playing defense. Got me doing things that I think I could do.
Like what? What did he, where was his impact felt the most there?
Probably on the defensive end. But he was a good man. You know, things wasn't right. And in my mind, I would just go to talk to him. Personal stuff. You know what I mean? And he was a good man. That whole, you know, that staff was great. Getting traded, man. That whole, I probably cried for a week. I was real emotional at home. I was really emotional at home. Because I just thought, you know, I did everything the right way in Boston. I thought I could just finish that year out, you know, free agent. You know, I could just finish it out. It was great with the community. I love Boston. I love the people there. I got relationships there. It was tough, man. It was really tough. I think, you know, I say it, my doc, and I say it to people that's close to me. That's why I lost the passion. After that, in my last 3 years, I didn't really want to pay no more. I didn't really care. I was just holding on just to get a check. Mm-hmm. You know, when I left Boston, I was just done.
I mean, when you said you were upset when you were traded, I mean, did you see it coming at all? Did you see any of that?
No. Yeah. That's the problem. Yeah. How you see it coming when you just come back from the Eastern Conference Finals? We had a good year that nobody expected, and I did great. I didn't have nobody. at the time.
And that couldn't have worked out worse for the Celtics because Vin Baker was in a different place back then.
You know, that's where I got traded from, and one of the scouts there and all the jumbo stuff. They wanted to help Vin Baker. They wanted to bring him back to Connecticut area. And, you know, they spared my contract. They spared my talent. You know, like, oh, we could probably survive without Kenny Anderson being the point. Let's gamble on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I understand the gamble, but they gambled and it didn't work out. But that's, like I said, again, you know, you live and learn. You, when you get older, you realize things and you just you don't have no control over it. But that kind of messed me up a little bit.
I forget the numbers from the team numbers from that last Celtic year, but you guys were jacking up threes left and right that
Paul
year.
And
that
was, Antoine was jacking up threes. She was just jacking up threes.
Yeah. Antoine had the great line when he was with Dallas when somebody asked him, why don't you shoot threes? Well, there are no fours in the NBA. He just always had that gunner mentality. Yeah. What did you make as a teammate of Antoine and Paul? What did you make of the dynamic between those two?
Oh, it was great. You know, that's what we had. You got a team, and you got to roll with it. You know, those are the guys that was gonna make us win regardless, through the good times and the bad times. You know, you knew Antoine was gonna jack up threes, you know, good or bad. But when he's on, he's on. Paul Pierce was just a great player, gym rat. You get threes, you get what you want. You can post him up. He could pass. He was the ultimate teammate. Great guy. I'm happy for him. To see him grow like that after 97. He was my rookie. I went and represented the Celtics at the lottery, and then we drafted him number 10, and he was really pissed off that he fell to 10. Thought he should have been higher. Should have been, but it was great for the Celtics.
I mean, when did you see in Pierce kind of the great player that he eventually became? When did you see, you know, you mentioned you saw him early on, he was your rookie, but when did you see him become you know, the signs that he was going to become Paul Pierce, one of them?
Rookie year, basically. He was just, and then I practiced with him. I saw it. You know, I saw what he was capable of doing, taking over a game. Just he was a gym rat. He was always working on his game. You know, wanted to be the best. And I think the only thing, you know, as people get better and get great, you know, their personality changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. You just saw that, but it was great
with Rick. And we talked about this a little bit at the top, but the intensity of him was that. People always talked about he was almost too intense at all times. And the 82-game season, it's hard to be that locked in and, you know, and not balanced as you should be. How was it for you with his sort of intensity level?
Yeah, I was fine with me. I was a veteran. I understood him. But that's what, you know, he was, emotions on his sleeve. You can't do that. You couldn't do that in the NBA. It's too long of a season. I think it just wore him down, wore the players down. You know, he just was hard at practice, which is, you know, some guys need it, some guys not. You just got to know what buttons to push.
When he came in that day and told the media that Larry Bird wasn't walking through that door and Kevin McHale, that's when I knew he was probably done. Like, you can't just assault the press in Boston just because you're not going to win that fight. You know, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? So he was hard on himself because he wasn't winning, period. You know, it's a tough town if you lose it. And we was losing at the time, and he wanted success. He's a hard worker. Very, very great. He's a great coach, but I just think he's where he should be on a college level.
What did Jim O'Brien change with those teams? Because he was Rick's lieutenant for a long time. A lot of people just assumed he was a stopgap for the rest of that season, and then somebody else would come on. But you guys did turn it around. You did get into the playoffs.
He didn't change anything. He changed, like, the personality. Mm-hmm. He was like, I don't see anything type of coach. Like, I'm not, you know, he was more of a professional, like a pros coach. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't nitpick. Not that Rick Pitino nitpicked. I don't know if I'm using Pitino as a drill sergeant, but he was a little more stickler, a little harder. O'Brien was kind of, you know, in between. Like, can I say, just selective hearing. Didn't let stuff bother him as much. And, you know, we didn't practice as hard at times. We went over what we needed to go over, and that was that. He was a little more lighter on us. Mm-hmm. You know,
he was always, I remember this about him, that, you know, if people tried to bait him to say something critical about you guys, he'd be like, nope, that was a great shot. Like, everything, like, it doesn't matter if Antoine went 1-for-20 from 3-point range. It was a great shot. They were all good-looking shots.
See, that's what I'm saying. That was the difference, you know, of coaching. He didn't do nothing. We didn't change no offense. Oh, you know, nothing. We just, the voice was different. the mannerisms was different. And I think everybody on the team, you know, led, you know, with Jim O'Brien, respected him a great deal. They respected Rick Pitino. But I just think the way O'Brien was able to adjust to the personality of the team was just awesome.
When you look back at your career, a lot of stuff is out of your control. Yeah. Being traded, a lot is out of your control. But if there's something you could have done differently, what would you do?
I'd probably just work harder in the offseason. You know, I just would have worked harder. Mm-hmm. I tell my son that, you know, all my kids. I didn't work extremely hard in the offseason when I got a little older. Mm-hmm. When I got older, I had to work a lot more harder, and I didn't. As far as offseason, you know, I didn't take it serious. I had so much talent. I was able to, like I tell myself, if you have half of the career I'm have, you should thank God under the circumstances. I think if I would have worked a lot harder in the offseason, I would have been better.
You've tried to talk, and you have talked to people about, you know, saving your money and and making the right decision there. Because I think you made like $63 million in your career, and you had some problems with it later on. You know, what do you tell people and younger players about their money?
I just tell them, you know, there's a want and a need, and, you know, be frugal, you know, learn how to say no. I didn't lose my money investments or anything like that. I just took care of a lot of people and had a big heart, and I was able to save enough money where I'm not, you know, I'm not totally broke or anything like that. I'm well off, and I should have a lot more money, but I was my mother, rest in peace, my family, I gave them money. I didn't have no gambling addiction or anything. I just spent my money at times foolishly, you know what I mean? And I, you know, I can look in the mirror and say that, but, you know, I spent my money, but like my accountant always said, you didn't even spend your money. Other people spent your money. So I just, you know, learn how to say no and also handle your money right. You know, don't spend your money foolishly. And that's what I did at a young age. When you come from nothing, you just really don't understand it. You think you're going to be in the lead and play forever. And that's not possible.
Yeah, I remember some of the stories you've told in the past about 10 cars owning at one time. You said you bought a house in Atlanta that you were like never at one point. I mean, was that sort of what
foolish? Exactly. You know what I mean? Cars was a fetish of mine at the time. They depreciate as soon as you drive them off the market. You should only have two cars basically anyway. If that, a truck and a car, you know what I mean? I was just spending money foolishly. A house, big house that I didn't even live at. Other people lived in. They got all the glory out of it. You know, you look back on it, like, foolish, stupid, you know, bottom line, you know what I mean? But it was my money, and I did some stupid things with it. But like I said, I was able. And then I had kids. I got 8 kids. You know, that's another thing. You know, I had 8 kids, child support, and now I'm married, my third wife. That's another. The wives take your money. So I've had some things, you know, in my life that things that I had control over, but, you know, didn't really control it wisely. And I paid for it, but God bless that I was able to, you know, keep some of my money.
Do you find that the guys you talk to about this, that they're receptive to what you're saying? Because, think about it from you. Like, it might even be hard for you, for 21-year-old Kenny Anderson, to see, you know, 45-year-old Kenny Anderson coming in and say, well, what does he know? I got all this money. It's hard to teach that kind of lesson.
Bottom, all you do is could give advice. You know what I mean? Some guys is best, you know, experience is the best teacher. Sometimes guys got to go through it and live it themselves. You see all the bad. I think it's getting better now. These young guys are handling money, especially the new stars. They're doing a lot. They're great. They're investing their money wisely, not spending crazy. They're doing it the right way. Because of the past players that they see. There's other guys that's worse than me. Don't have a pot to piss in. It's like just terrible. You know what I mean? So I think it's from guys. They listen a little bit, but some guys they gotta experience it.
Yeah, I think some of the stories that have been written and talked about have been kind of enlightening. You know, even Antoine, the guy that you played with. You know, there's so much out there with these guys that just don't have it, that have lost all of it, and it's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy, but you like I said, I always go back to your foundation. If your foundation is not functional, it's dysfunctional, you're going to have problems. If you come from nothing and You know, like my mother wasn't educated, you know, about money and how to spend money. So, you know, I'm not going to say no to my mother. You know, I'm going to take care of my mother regardless. You know what I mean? She didn't tell me to go invest and do this and don't. She helped spend my money. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I think in Antoine, his situation, he was a gambler. He said he's an addicted gambler. He had also a big heart. Then he lost some stuff in real estate. All those things mixed in one is a terrible ingredient.
When you look back at some of the things that you either spent money on or allowed people to spend your money on, what's something you look back on and you're like, I cannot believe that was something.
Yeah, just cars. Yeah. I shouldn't have spent no money on no cars. Dude, I was buying cars for my brother and just stupid stuff. Family members, just cars, probably cars.
A lot of cars.
11 cars, you know, I have 9 cars in my garage, in my house that I couldn't drive. You know what I mean? We could only drive one at a time. The battery was dying, mm-hmm. You know, all of them. I couldn't even drive. I had to get, like, battery chargers, plug them in the wall when I wasn't driving them. It was stupid. I had fun, though, at the time.
The best teammate that you ever had?
You know, I have a few. I love playing in Portland with Cliff Robinson. Love playing with Eric Williams in Boston. Mm-hmm. I still love Antoine Walk. We had fun. Paul Pierce, had the pleasure to play with Larry Johnson in Charlotte, Reggie Miller, and I had some great teammates. But, you know, I'm going to go back to my college days with Lethal Weapon 3, with Brian Oliver and Dennis Scott. Those probably my ultimate best teammates. But, you know, pros, I guess, Boston. That Boston team was just real close, very mm-hmm. close team.
You see the business that Cliff Robinson's in now? You're gonna
Uncle Cliff. I don't smoke. I don't smoke. I never smoke.
Right. That's incredible that Cliff
Uncle Spliffy.
I think that's amazing. Because the word was out on him during his playing days that was a badly kept secret if it was one with Cliff and smoking. So I love it that he's taken the new laws that are out there and you make it into a business.
He won't get no more fines.
or suspended. For that matter. A couple of times I think he got dinged with that. The year that was the toughest for you, when you think the playing
2005.
Year.
No, 2005 was the worst year of my life. My mother passed away. I was played with half a year with the Hawks, half a year with the Clippers for like 4 games, and my mother passed away. I just said, yeah, this is over, man. I don't feel like dealing with it no more. Mm-hmm. That's when I retired basketball. 2005, you don't want one of those years. You don't want one of them years. Just everything. Life, everything. I'm like, I don't want 2005 no more.
The first couple of years after your career, how were they? Just because some guys get used to a certain...
Yeah, it was dark. I had my dark times. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do. You know, I did go back to school and get my BA from St. Thomas University in 2010. But my first 2 years out was kind of hard. But I had fun, but it was just, I was roller coaster. I was depressed. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life and everything. So it was rough.
What turned the corner for you?
I just think my family, you know, my wife, my third wife, and just seeing my son and my daughter in the house. You know what I mean? I just knew I had to clean up and be a good father. Give them a great example. Like, yeah, you know, they're growing now. They realizing, you know, about life, you know what I mean? And I don't want them to see me do anything, you know, that they're going to try to do when they get older. Mm-hmm. So I just really want to be a better father.
And you've got the documentary coming mm-hmm. out. We've talked a little bit about you might be doing a book at some point. I mean, what's the next 10 years look like for you?
I don't know. I'm a coach kids. I got to get back. You know, I would love a good prep school, high school. I love high school and prep school. I would love to coach on a college level if the opportunity presents itself. But I'm going to coach kids. I'm going to be in the gym some form or fashion. I love going in the gym, teaching kids the game. And that's the youth, high school kids. Got my AAU program, South Florida Elite, mm-hmm. you know, that I'm big with. You know, I just want to give back. And like you said, like we talked about, listen, all my life lessons, you know, if it's finances, if it's spiritual, if it's basketball, whatever, I can give that off to a young man and it can help him early in his life. So then he could, you know, get older and have a productive life just to give back, just to play it forward. And then that kid can come back and say, hey, thank you, Coach Anderson, you helped me. That's all, man. And I did my job. But I think that's the process we all have to do. Help one kid. Then maybe that kid will come back and help help another. Slow process, but I think that's the way we got to do it.
Let's just say right now that that Celtic team would have beaten the Lakers in the finals. Let's just say
wow.
It. Let's just put it out there. Come on, you would have won. Just admit it.
Man, that would be awesome.
You would have beaten Shaq and Kobe. You would have stopped
Shaq
that
would
run.
Have been a monster, though.
Who was the center on that team? Who was your...
Mark Blount.
Mark Blount, okay.
Yeah, he would have had a rough series.
Mark Blount was a wacky guy.
He would have had a rough series with Shaq. Shaq was too powerful and dominant. But I think we could have held our own in any other position. But that's just that center position. He would have been too much.
Well, Kenny, good luck with the documentary, with the book, with everything, man. You'll always have a fan in me from those years in Boston, man. They were a lot of fun to watch. So I appreciate you stopping by.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, man. Good to see you doing well, and great job. Thank you.
That's it for the Vertical Podcast. Remember, you can download this episode and more, really anywhere you can download podcasts. My thanks to our sponsor, Jack Irwin. Please support them like they support this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and listen each week to all three Vertical Podcasts. You can find Woj, JJ Redick, and me on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else you subscribe to podcasts. Also, don't forget, Thursday night, the Vertical Draft Special that's live on Yahoo Sports beginning at 6:30.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.